Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we hear from Wall Street investigative reporter Pam Martins about the state of corruption within the structures of Wall Street and the mega banks. Pam Martins retired from Wall Street in 2006 after 21 years. She wasn't a so-called mover and shaker. She managed the life savings of regular people. During her career, Pam spent the last decade protesting in the streets of Manhattan or testifying over various Wall Street abuses, including its private justice system. In April of 2001, she was thrown in jail by the NYPD while peacefully protesting on a public sidewalk in front of Citigroup's shareholders meeting being held at taxpayer-financed Carnegie Hall. This is, she says, what alerted her to the cronyism between the NYPD, Citigroup, and other big Wall Street firms. Pam Martins had started to write about Wall Street corruption for Counterpunch almost immediately after retiring. By 2011, Pam realized that Wall Street corruption was getting worse, and she needed to do more to get the word out. Next, she and her husband, Russ Martins, had built the site WallStreetOnParade.com. And those past Counterpunch articles and more can be found at that site. On the About page of their site, it reads, quote, Wall Street is a jungle of devices to affect an institutionalized wealth transfer system. The goal of this site is to provide the jungle guide to the 99% in the hope of bringing about citizen-inspired change. I had been requesting interviews with Pam for a couple of years, and she had graciously declined. Pam, however, had agreed to answer some written questions that I sent her, and I'm going to go through them right now. So the first question I wrote to her, I wrote, can you begin by taking us through some critical turning points all the way up to now and the significant events that have led up to the current economic state? And Pam Martins from WallStreetOnParade.com writes, today's mega banks, the so-called too big to fail banks that crashed the U.S. economy in 2008, are unique in American history with the exception of the era of the 1920s leading up to the crash of 1929. In fact, two of the mega banks that caused a great deal of harm in that earlier era also played a major role in the crash of 2008. Those banks are J.P. Morgan and Citigroup, the latter having been known as National City Bank in 1929. Until the public fully grasps the interrelatedness of these two eras and takes to the streets to protest for change, the U.S. financial system will edge ever closer to another epic collapse. In 1929, there was no law barring speculative Wall Street firms from expecting deposits from savers. And at that time, there was no FDIC insurance on bank deposits. The Wall Street banks were allowed to take deposits while simultaneously using high leverage to make stock market gambles. These same mega banks also owned retail brokerage firms that sold toxic stocks and bonds to the general public, frequently giving small investors margin loans to take on far more risk than was suitable. The house of cards began to collapse with a big stock market sell-off on October 29, 1929. Over the next 3 years, the stock market would lose 90% of its value from peak to trough. It did not regain the high it set in 1929 until a quarter of a century later. The 1929 crash ushered in the Great Depression and severe deflation because there was no immediate safety nets to sustain consumer spending. Depositors in failed banks lost all of their savings or received only pennies on the dollar. There was no Social Security payments at the time because Social Security didn't exist, nor was there unemployment insurance. The economy just fell off a cliff. Job losses mounted and public outrage fueled intensive Senate hearings, which thoroughly examine the Wall Street practices that caused the crash, unlike our hit-and-miss hearings since 2008. As a result of those hearings in the 30s and bold front-page headlines placing the blame squarely on the dirty dealings of the so-called banksters of that era, in 1933, Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, which simultaneously created federal deposit insurance on bank deposits, while making it illegal for banks holding those deposits to engage in stock market operations or the underwriting of stocks. That Glass-Steagall legislation served this country admirably until 1999, when Wall Street titans such as Sandy Weill of Citigroup convinced Congress to repeal the legislation on the basis that it was old-fashioned. Weill's premise was that financial supermarkets taking deposits while offering investments and retail brokerage services was a more efficient banking model. In reality, of course, that was the same disastrous model that had crashed the financial system in 1929 and brought on the Great Depression. I recently heard another version of that. This is me speaking. I'm going through Pam Martin's response here, but I recently heard a different version of that. And we'll talk about that later. Continuing with Pam's response. In a 2012 interview with Bill Moyers on PBS, John Reed, the former head of Citibank, who had agreed to merge his deposit-taking bank with Sandy Weill's Wall Street operations in 1998, at a time when it was still illegal to do so, explained Mr. Weill's real motivation. Reed told Moyers, quote, "Sandy Weill, I mean, his whole life was to accumulate money. And he said, 'John, we could be so rich. Being rich never crossed my mind as an objective value. I almost was embarrassed that somebody would say that out loud. It might be happening, but you wouldn't want to say it.'" End quote. Obscene compensation on Wall Street also characterized the 1929 era and today's era. Charles Mitchell, the head of Citigroup's predecessor, National City Bank, was earning 200 times the average American salary in the late 20s. Likewise, Sandy Weill received some of the most obscene paydays in corporate history. When Weill stepped down as CEO in 2003, he had amassed over $1 billion in compensation. Weill's coddling board of directors even allowed him to sell 5.6 million of his shares back to the corporation in one fell swoop, earning him $264 million. Just 2 years after Weill stepped down as chairman of Citigroup in 2006, the bank was insolvent and required the largest bailout in U.S. history. A total of more than $2 trillion in below-market-rate loans from the New York Federal Reserve, over $300 billion in government asset guarantees, and $45 billion in taxpayer equity infusions. According to the Government Accountability Office, the New York Fed, which is now under Senate investigation for being a captured regulator of Wall Street, doled out a cumulative total of over $16 trillion in low-cost loans to domestic and foreign banks during the 2008 to 2010 crisis, reaching more than $1 trillion in loans outstanding on some days. But the proof that this era is exponentially more corrupt and more dangerous than the era Weill cloned from 1929 is that instead of passing strict regulation to rein in Wall Street abuses this time around by again separating deposit-taking banks from Wall Street casinos, Congress has sat idly by as the Federal Reserve allowed the Franken banks to become even bigger. J.P. Morgan Chase was allowed to buy Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual during the 2008 collapse. Bank of America was allowed to buy the retail brokerage firm and investment bank Merrill Lynch. the hubristic regulator, the New York Federal Reserve, which was in charge of examining these mega banks leading up to the crash but failed to see the mushrooming risk, was given even broader regulatory powers after the 2008 crash. And instead of immediately restoring the Glass-Steagall Act, which the situation was clearly screaming for, Congress has allowed the continuance of Wall Street casino speculation to coexist alongside FDIC-insured deposits, raising the very real risk of another epic collapse at any time. Now, that was Pam Martin's response to the question of, take us through some critical turning points all the way up to now and the significant events that have led up to the current economic state. Pam Martins of WallStreetOnParade.com. The next question, could you explain the depth of fraudulent charges against J.P. Morgan and why the NYPD and the federal government continue to work side by side with them? And her answer, in 2011, I was doing research on Wall Street's ties to the New York Police Department when I stumbled across a foreign news site that had photos for sale of the interior of the Lower Manhattan Security Coordination Center. That facility had cost taxpayers at least $150 million to facilitate surveillance of the comings and goings of pedestrians in first Lower Manhattan and now also Midtown Manhattan. It's a super high-tech facility using thousands of street-level cameras and license plate readers, and bizarrely, it is not only staffed by the NYPD, but it includes employees of the serially charged Wall Street firms, including J.P. Morgan Chase, which has signed a deferred prosecution agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice and admitted to felony counts for involvement in the Bernard Madoff Ponzi scheme. While the NYPD has refused to honor New York state law and respond to my Sunshine Act request for further details, we know that these Wall Street firms are working elbow to elbow with the NYPD because the foreign news agency captured photographs of the brass nameplates on the workstations inside the facility showing the names of Wall Street firms such as J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs as having surveillance space there. We reported on all of this in 2011. Then, in early 2012, we reported on the fact that 60 Minutes did a puff piece on the surveillance center on September 25th, 2011, just 8 days after the Occupy Wall Street protests began in Lower Manhattan. The 60 Minutes program failed to mention that the surveillance center was jointly staffed with the NYPD and Wall Street firms that are serially to this day charged with crime after crime. I spoke directly with the co-producer of this program, and he conceded that he was aware the Wall Street firms had personnel on the premises. I reached out for an official explanation from 60 Minutes. Kevin Tedesco, the executive director, stated in a written response that, quote, "We find your inquiry somewhat puzzling. This was a story about defending against terrorism, probably the most important issue of our times," end quote. If an iconic investigative news program such as 60 Minutes doesn't see a problem with Wall Street firms that are serially charged with crimes being deputized to sit elbow to elbow with law enforcement in a surveillance center, potentially spying on their own employees heading to FBI offices as whistleblowers, what hope is there that other corporate media will probably ferret out these types of abuses of the public trust? What hope is there that these abuses will become bold headlines on the front pages of newspapers, as they did during the Senate investigations of the 1930s? And I have to take issue with the 60 Minutes official who said terrorism is probably the most important issue of our time. He said that in 2012, when it was abundantly clear that the Wall Street collapse, subpar economic growth, mushrooming wealth and income inequality, 46 million fellow citizens living below the poverty level, unprecedented homelessness of school children, and continuing crimes on a massive scale by Wall Street were the most important issues of our time. Ivy League educated men on Wall Street had wrecked the U.S., not terrorist plotting in the Middle East. The next question I asked Pam, you wrote in an article about how PBS exposed Wall Street as an institutionalized wealth transfer mechanism by moving the savings of the little guy into the pockets of the very rich. Producer Martin Smith said, quote, take an account with a $100,000 balance and reduce it by 2% a year. At the end of 50 years, that 2% annual charge would subtract $63,000 from your account, a loss of 63%, leaving you with just a little over $36,000. Could you explain what risks are now involved in having a 401k plan? She responds, this is Pam Martins from WallStreetOnParade.com. Martin Smith, in his PBS Frontline program, The Retirement Gamble, correctly revealed that through the compounding effect over a lifetime of work and saving in a 401k, a 2% annual fee imposed by a Wall Street firm would eat up two-thirds of what you were attempting to put away for retirement. I double-checked the math and verified it in a story on our website, Wall Street on Parade. The 401k was a remarkable coup d'etat for Wall Street. It enabled moneyed interests to not only enshrine their wealth transfer system by transferring money management of retirement funds into the hands of the inexperienced little guy and away from professional pension managers, but it also diabolically made all of these millions of 401k participants cheerleaders for the stock market going up. So if the crime on Wall Street keeps growing, but the stock market continues to set new highs, this 401k segment of the public will not advocate for change. If that wasn't clear, we go into that a little bit more in depth as we go along. All right, this is a great, here's another question I asked Pam. This is a great line you wrote in the Abacus story. Despite barrels of newsprint ink and acres of deforestation devoted over the past year to the London whale story, the press has failed to adequately enlighten the public as to the significance of this story. If it had, we would not still be debating the wisdom of restoring the Glass-Steagall Act to separate Wall Street casinos from banks holding insured deposits. All right. She responds. It's not really a question, but she responded to this statement. The outrageous scandal of the J.P. Morgan London whale episode was that the bank was using hundreds of billions of dollars of the bank's depositors' money, not its own capital, to make wild gambles and exotic derivative trades in London. It fessed up to losing $6.2 billion of those deposits. How much it eventually lost, we don't know, because it moved those trades into its investment bank and stopped acknowledging the losses. It was not a secret that these were funds belonging to depositors. It came out clearly during the Senate hearings, and the CEO, Jamie Dimon, acknowledged that fact. So one would have expected to see bold front-page newspaper headlines blaring, quote, J.P. Morgan gambles with insured deposits and loses $6.2 billion. But nothing like that happened in corporate media. If even one major newspaper, such as the New York Times or the Washington Post, had properly covered this story on their front pages, showing that the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation had done nothing to stop the nation's largest bank from gambling with taxpayer-backstopped insured deposits, there might have been an increased momentum for passing a new Glass-Steagall Act. Here's another question I asked her. Pam Martins, what are your thoughts on reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act, and why was it important to be in place? Her answer, the unprecedented wealth and income inequality, which is sapping the nation's ability to grow and create new jobs and new industry, is buttressed by the current structure of Wall Street. The slogan, that heads they win, tails you lose, is precisely how the game is structured without the reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act. When J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon was asked on a 2012 call with analysts what was going on in its chief investment office where the London Whale trading was taking place. He said it was investing surplus deposits from its commercial bank. In prior years, when those bets paid off big, the windfall profits did not go to the people who involuntarily risked their capital, the depositors. In fact, the depositors did not even know these huge risks were taking place with FDIC-insured funds. The outside winnings went to pay obscene salaries to traders and upper management, and to reward shareholders through higher stock prices. Now, what if the losses had grown so big that the bank failed? Clearly, a bank this size, with over $1 trillion in deposits, would have to be bailed out by the taxpayer, continuing Wall Street's game of socializing losses and privatizing profits. Very interesting. What have you learned about high-frequency trading, and why is it important to keep this in mind within the context of Wall Street corruption? Pam Martin's answer. This is Pam Martin's from WallStreetOnParade.com. It had just occurred to me that the answer to every one of your questions could accurately be answered by stating, quote, it's just another facet of the institutionalized wealth transfer being run by the major Wall Street banks. High-frequency trading simply adds a new dimension to the corruption because now the stock and futures exchanges in New York, Chicago, are not just turning a blind eye to securities manipulation, but are jumping in with both feet to share in the winnings. Under U.S. securities law, exchanges serve as quasi-regulators. They must police the trading that occurs on their exchange to make certain that there is a level playing field and no one gets an illegal edge. But instead of doing this, exchanges are selling for millions of dollars. The ability to get an early peek at prices to those willing to pay hefty premiums to co-locate Wall Street firms' computers next to the computers of the exchange, which can offer precious millisecond advantages to high-frequency traders using algorithms and artificial intelligence programs to trade. Then there is a multi-tiered system of data feeds. Exchanges sell a faster direct data feed to those who can afford to pay for it, while giving the little guy the slower data from the Securities Information Processor, or SIP. Since speed of accessing pricing information directly correlates to trading profits, the general public that can't afford to pay for these direct data lines is at a serious disadvantage. Currently, there is a lawsuit against the futures exchanges in Chicago, which is alleging that one of the worst practices that rigged stock prices in 1929 is alive again today, that of wash trades. Wash trades occur when the same beneficial owner is both the buyer and the seller. The lawsuit, filed by three veteran traders in Chicago against the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, states that the management of the exchange is tolerating wash trades by high-frequency traders, quote, because they comprise, by some estimates, 50% of exchange defendants' total trading volume. That's the first I've heard of this lawsuit, and it would be something very important to report on. By someone. The next question to Pam. Hourly wages have stayed the same since the 1970s, yet the markets continue to close at record profits. In your research, to what do you attribute the consistent record profits reported on Wall Street? Her answer. Clearly, the answer to this question is again the fact that Wall Street has crony regulators and cronies in Congress who are running a protection racket so that Wall Street can continue its institutionalized wealth transfer system. As one quick example, what kind of democracy tolerates the same bank charging 14% interest on credit cards to ravaged customers who are still attempting to recover from the economic collapse caused by these banks, while the same mega bank is allowed to dip into its depositors' funds to make its wagers while paying a fraction of 1% interest to the depositors' account? Here's another question. to Pam. What financial system model do you envision that would support a healthy, just economy and markets functioning for the behalf of people in this country? Answer from Pam Martins. There are a number of essential steps that Congress must take to restore fairness as well as trust in our capital markets. Right now, the markets are completely dysfunctional and manipulated. Glass-Steagall has to be restored permanently and quickly, separating deposit-taking banks from trading and underwriting firms. In addition, there has to be a cap placed on the amount of domestic deposits that any one bank can hold to prevent a catastrophic failure, more taxpayer bailouts, and also to ramp up getting money flowing to the real economy. Right now, just four banks out of the thousands that exist in the U.S. control almost half of all deposits. I'll read that again. Right now, just four banks out of the thousands that exist in the U.S. control almost half of all deposits. As of the second quarter of this year, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Citigroup controlled 45% of all deposits. If these banks use these deposits to speculate or invest in unsound ventures rather than making loans to credible businesses to expand, it's a serious drag on economic growth and job creation. We need to expose 401k plans as little more than legalized pickpocketing of the little guy and return to a system of defined benefit plans managed by professional money managers and offered by corporations to boost morale and improve productivity. To restore integrity and trust to Wall Street, we need to end the involvement of the Federal Reserve in anything other than monetary policy. It has been an abysmal failure as a regulator of Wall Street. The public knows it, Congress knows it, and regulators on every other continent know it. The U.S. Treasury needs to get its nose out of the Wall Street regulation racket as well. It has no business at all being involved in this role. The budgets for the primary regulators of Wall Street and the banks, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation should be doubled so that they can attract and retain competent lawyers and enforcement staff. There should be a 3-year ban on leaving a regulator and going to work at a bank or Wall Street firm. The same 3-year buffer should be imposed on leaving a bank, Wall Street firm, or a law firm heavily tied to Wall Street and going to work at a regulator. This would avoid today's unseemly situation where the head of the SEC, Mary Jo White, came directly from a law firm serving most of the major Wall Street banks, where the U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew is a former Citigroup official who accepted a $940,000 bonus from the very taxpayer funds that were shoring up the insolvent bank because his employment contract promised that bonus if he landed a prized federal government job. And finally, eliminating Wall Street's private justice program, where both customer and employee claims against the firms are heard in secret before an industry-run arbitration forum, would open the disinfecting sunlight of public courtrooms and restore the early warning system to patterns of corruption before that corruption tanks the U.S. economy again. Shine some light on the Wall Street's private justice program. And that covered the her response to this dysfunctional structure. Another area that I had talked with her about were the banker deaths. And we can go through that, but she had asked me respectfully that to put this at the end of the Q&A so it doesn't distract from the economic and structural reform debate. We're going to open the phone lines. And I want to just mention a couple things about the banking deaths. And she wrote an article. She says, you have permission to read excerpts from an article that her and her husband, Russ Martins, had written titled, Why J.P. Morgan Stands Out in the Banker Deaths Matter. In the past 6 months, 5 current workers and 2 former workers of J.P. Morgan Chase have died under unusual circumstances, adding to the tragedy. All 7 were in their late 20s or 30s, and 3 of the deaths involved alleged falls from buildings, a rare form of death even during the height of the financial crisis in 2008. According to the New York City Department of Health, there were just 93 deaths resulting from leaps from buildings in Manhattan and the boroughs during 2008, a time when century-old iconic Wall Street firms collapsed and terminated tens of thousands of workers. Those 93 deaths represented just 0.0001165. Oh, that's 0.0001165 of the city's population of 8 million. J.P. Morgan's global workforce population is just 260,000. No other major Wall Street bank comes close in terms of young worker deaths over the past 6 months. Of equal concern since December, the early deaths related to J.P. Morgan have been coming at a rate of 1 or 2 a month, almost like clockwork. The series of strange deaths has brought unwelcome attention to the fact that mega banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase are allowed to secretly collect life insurance proceeds on the lives of their employees and former employees without disclosing the amounts to the families or the public or their shareholders. Other corporations are likewise engaged in this practice. The payments are a closely guarded secret between the companies and the insurers who collect the lucrative premiums. Go to some of your calls, and if there was an accident, accidentally hung you up, we're sorry about that, and please call back. Hi, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes, it is.
Oh, all right. I was number 2, so I guess the accident was number 1. How are you? It's Antonio.
Oh, Antonio, good to hear from you. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm glad you're taking calls. Not too many shows take calls anymore. All right.
Yeah.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
I wish she was on the show, because here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can get it to her or follow it up.
Or a listener could answer.
Yeah, possibly. Over the weekend, PBS was raising money, so they had financial advisor Susie Orman on. And I think she's pretty, from what I see on the TV, she's pretty pretty honest, and she's heartfelt giving advice. So she suggests not these things like 401k and all this. So I'm wondering, my question would be, what does your guest think of her and her advice, and also some of her tactics? If a crash or devalue of the dollar would happen, is it good to put it or follow her advice if you're in for the long haul? Is it something that can, what she's recommending, like if something heavy happened, you just leave it alone, and then maybe it'll straighten itself out.
Yeah, you ride it out.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Or is it just, it just doesn't matter because it's all part of the monetary system anyway, and it's not, you know, you're at the mercy of whatever happens, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great question, Antonio, and I will send that to Pam.
Yeah, what does she think of her?
My guess would be... You're getting screwed on the 401k because, you know, she points that out. If Wall Street is taking 2% every year, and she said, you know, that's she did the math.
She doesn't suggest that. She doesn't suggest that. She does. Actually, some of the things she suggested for a young person seem really good.
Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. So I don't know, but that would be my question. Carry on. I'm glad you're taking calls again, and I'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Good to hear from you, Antonio.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. And we're going to go to the other call, another call here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. I'll make a comment, two comments. Mm-hmm. One is, on the Juliana Furlano show today, she said that when you see those contracts with your cell phone, there can be forced arbitration in there, so that if anything comes, and this is for jobs and a lot of things, read the fine print, and there's some kind of website, lostinthefineprint.org, so that's good to know about. But what I wanted to say is, I was so surprised to hear what you said at the end of your comments from her about the bank getting the insurance. That's unbelievable. That's absolutely amazing. All the murders.
This is the investigative work of Pam Martins. I don't really know of anyone else who did this work, and her husband Russ, of course, and that's on WallStreetOnParade.com. But I was shocked. Okay. It's tax-free, by the way.
Yeah, it's just shock. I mean, in other words, somebody dies and their family doesn't get the insurance, the bank gets it.
That's right.
It's unbelievable. I'm so upset to hear that. The deaths are terrible to begin with, and then to hear this, I mean, like they're forced deaths so they can collect this money and pay off all this stupid stuff they're doing. But thanks so much, Jeff.
Oh, thank you very much for
the
call.
Listen all the time, love it.
Oh, wonderful. It's good to hear from you.
Bye.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Hi. I love your show. I just have to tell you that, first off.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for all the work you do. I mean, it's riveting a lot of the time.
Excellent. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, I think that there's a lot of people that I've listened to on WBAI, a lot of the callers that have called into other shows. There's been a lot of discussions on the financial situation in the country, and I think Gary Knowles covered a lot of stuff, but it's just very interesting, I think, how some of the listeners that I've heard that have called in have put together, you know, a lot of what's going on with the police and the arming of the police, and that in the future there's going to be an uprising. And it's always been interesting to me that those 401ks, you know, they're not really technically insured, right? So, I mean, we all think and we all hope that that money will be there, but it doesn't have to be because, again, it's not really insured. There's no one guaranteeing it.
There's that as well, but there's also a fee that Wall Street charges, and that adds up over time.
So. Yeah, but you know what? I kind of feel like that fee has always been part of the whole process, and now they're at a point where they want more than that.
And Pam is saying these aren't socially responsible money managers, and you shouldn't give your money to them. And in some type of reform that needs to occur, she suggests that competent money managers, as she was, need to handle retirement accounts and not a Wall Street casino.
Until Citizens United is overturned, it's highly unlikely that any type of reform would be put in, because the people that have all the money are the ones creating the legislation at this point.
The movement now of more and more people in the streets is needed, she suggests, for some kind of...
I would agree, but I live in New Jersey, so I'm pretty much in the Northeast. I travel the country, and I can tell you firsthand that, you know, some of those southern states and Republican areas, the people, even though they're the ones that are being affected, they don't really see the problems. They don't really foresee the issues. You know, it's very strange to me.
Well, Pam pointed out that the corporate media is not reporting on this fairly. She gave that 60 Minutes example of it. So that was really blatant. Of course, PBS is doing really good work on this, but, you know, go ahead.
I think, again, back to the point of some of the listeners putting together the policing apparatus that is being put in place.
Protecting,
a lot of things, they're expecting, in my opinion, they may be expecting something big to happen, and if it does, they're going to be ready. You know, because it just seems odd they would.
Go ahead, caller. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry. It just seems odd that they would spend so much, right, on certain types of equipment and certain types of battle gear, if you will, you know,
I don't get
civilian
the
population.
I hear what you're saying. I don't get that sense. I feel that the population, the civilian population, is savvy and smart enough not to get caught in that crossfire and maneuver around it and just expose how ridiculous it is for these law enforcement personnel to have this gear, and they're here to serve the people. And I think once that starts to, you know, get into the minds and hearts of more and more people, then that shift starts to take place.
Well, I hope you're right, but the only thing I'm going to say is that, again, you said it best, or you mentioned it when you said that the mainstream media is not really publicizing or educating the public.
The corporate-owned media.
Well,
yeah.
If you go across the country, in a lot of areas, that's really all there is.
True, right.
So there's a lot of people. It's going to be. I know we have social media, but to be honest with you, from what I see, like in the New York area is one thing, but from what I see across the country, I don't see it happening. You know, to be honest, I really don't see it happening. So it's a tough educational curve, and then to top it off. Even though it's sort of like, you know, all these demonstrators right now with Michael Brown and mm-hmm. all that's going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my opinion, a lot of this is a diversion. Like, they kind of...
I see it as that as well, but I also see it as a catalyst because...
Yeah, but the thing
they're
is...
They're looking at the broader issues of police violence, and then, you know, you can just build from there in the awareness and start to really mobilize something.
But the thing is, if you look at the people and the power and how powerless they feel, which is why, you know, so much, there's so much frustration and so much revolt in a sense going on,
mm-hmm.
right?
As there should be.
At the same token, it's not like they're getting a great response from those in power. So therefore, I would say we would be in a similar situation against, you know, any large corporations that are obviously creating the legislation and have all the legislators in their pockets, because without those big corporations, those legislators wouldn't be legislating anyway. They
right.
wouldn't even have their own position, right?
That's...
So it's sort of like your own boss. How do you tell your boss no?
Yeah.
Right?
A lot of people...
It's a catch-22 to get the people to make a change.
They have,
you know,
to be informed.
I don't see Roosevelt there. So you had a guy one time that did it. It's going to be very, that's all I'm saying. It just
mm-hmm,
seems
mm-hmm.
difficult, but hopefully there'll be a solution. Thank you for your time. I don't want to keep you on the line.
Okay, thanks for calling. Appreciate those comments.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to go to another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Tom from the Bronx here.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I'd like to say that we are in a real bad pickle, very bad, from what you were saying, and it's very disturbing. Corporations, capitalism, unfortunately, is now cannibalizing itself and mistreating the workers that work for them. The wheels are coming off the car, so to speak, you know?
Yes, yes, indeed. It's probably happening in that sense, but they need the people's money for that to happen as
well.
Yeah,
but they have enough of their own, I would think.
Well, yeah, and the last caller was pointing out about politicians and legislators, and then Pam Martins had also pointed out that there have been very few Senate hearings on the financial collapse in 2008 and the bailouts and the banking fraud, but there was much more in-depth hearings after the collapse during the Great Depression. So that's a very interesting aspect as well. So the Senate hearings, no one's asking for more accountability, I suspect. Partially because they don't know and it's not being reported on as it should be. It should, you know, there should be a drumbeat to it. So hopefully the movement now that's causing people to go out in the streets from against police violence against minorities starts to gain momentum in other areas.
You know, the police have to realize that they have families too, and they may be banking in the same banks that we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they're going to be losers too. Their families are going to be losers.
Mm-hmm.
The story too.
We can't imagine the pressure that's being put on some of the police officers to, you know, be the way that they are and to keep their mouth keep quiet. And what we often find is the officers that are about to retire are the ones that are speaking out.
Yeah, they're the ones that that spill the beans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there aren't enough beans being spilled, I'll tell you that. I'm with Chase Bank.
Oh, right, with the highest deaths. The highest deaths, Tom.
They always try to sell me those annuities, and those annuities stink. And then you've got to wait so many years for those things to mature.
Yes, and what Pam was pointing out is that that goes into the Wall Street casino. So your money's being gambled with, you know.
Well, we're just behind the eight ball. Let's face it.
Right. And so Glass-Steagall is one of the main things to call for. I know the LaRouche PAC has been on this for many, many years.
I say bring back Glass-Steagall.
Great. Tom, thank you very much. Good to hear from you.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, caller.
This is Jeremiah. I'm calling from Jersey City. Thanks for a wonderful program again. I'm bringing the perspective of a musician. I'm an electric bassist. And the electric bass is a really good example of the evolution of the human mind, because when the electric bass first appeared, it was just a bastard instrument, so to speak, meaning it was upright bass players who were playing this new kind of instrument that wasn't yet a respected instrument. There wasn't really a technique for it. Fast forward a few decades, and bass players are playing rings around themselves. I mean, now there are guys who could sound like they're five guys playing at once. There's guys sight-reading Beethoven in a funk sensibility on the bass.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, unfortunately, it has happened. I mean, it happens across the board for good and for bad. Mm-hmm. But the same thing has happened in the science of greed.
Right, the technology around the trading and the high-frequency trading and all
that. The technology, mm-hmm. the methodology, mm-hmm. everything about it has gotten so masterful that if you're not in that science, which is most people, the 99%, so to speak, you're being manipulated by it, and we're being manipulated more and more severely. And, you know, we're now in the big data era, and I think we need to really, the problem that's going on now is we need to start organizing our information, because we've all been flooded with information, and we need to start disseminating more quickly what the people of goodwill are supposed to do on a step-by-step basis. You know, do we, for example, I've heard, put your money in a credit union, for example. You know, I mean, I know that's a very superficial thing. That's not going to fix the world's problems. But any number of responsible steps that we should take, I would love to see that clearly delineated and made more and more available.
Right. So more and more people need to bring this up in conversation and discussion. It's a very good point, caller. I appreciate that, where technology is a major factor. I often hear that in Glenn Greenwald's debates, technology, it's getting ahead of us, and that's why we're in this. But it's also policy, and it's also conscience and morality. Just because you have the technology doesn't mean you have to steal money from people. We're going to go to another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Rose.
Hi, Rose.
In Flemington, New Jersey. I think that there's a little bit of an ability for the average person to do a Luddite number on this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, first of all, clear up your debt. Become very non-cash conscious. Repair those clothes, cook those beans and rice, and just stop spending. I was listening earlier today, somebody carrying on about the Magic Friday, and they were going to be 4% more, but it was really 5% less. Henry Ford knew enough to make cars that were affordable, and he paid his people enough money so they could afford those cars. And when we stop spending and say, well, you know, those old clothes, you know, those funny ones in the closet we're not so crazy about, let's rework this. Let's fix up the flivver, throw some more curtains on the windows, and just shut down every aspect of spending, we might be able to defeat this beast.
You are so
right. By being
right.
Very modest.
You are right on the money with that. you're right on point with that. And
oh, I'm a disabled person, and I really fear what's going to happen with these coked up lunatics that just stole this last election. There was some dude out in Kansas City who threw out all these names from the voter registrations in 27 states, mostly Oriental, Latin, and of course blacks. And if anybody's really interested in this, check out, was it Greg Palast?
Mm-hmm.
He's on Al Jazeera.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be on, he was at the Palm Beach Post in 1980.
Yep.
And then we had The Guardian, but he explained how this was done. And I think that many of our friends of Missouri are really quite upset about that as well. There is a great malaise in this country. And unfortunately, folks who don't have much are really hurting, and it makes me sick that there are not those out there who could go back to the 60s mindset and say, you know, some rice and some beans and some neck bones will do.
Mm-hmm.
Let's cut that whole agri and pharmaceutical and big oil subsidy mindset out of our lives.
Cut it loose.
Cut it loose, say, uh-uh, we're not going to do that. We're going to stay home, we're going to take the bus and fix our old rags and just downgrade this economy to the point where it's like, oh, well, we're all so special now because we have our new Gucci's and Pucci's, and really focus these people as the parasites that they are. They're evil, they're rotten, they've gotten away with far too much for far too long, and maybe these little politicians who, you know, kiss up to them will understand that the American people have power, whether it's a depression, a recession, or what they would call a modest decline.
Rose, thank you for those comments. Really appreciate that. Voter fraud is the reference that Rose made, and Greg Palast wrote the book, The Best Democracy That Money Can Buy, about voter fraud. But listeners, again, the technology issue comes up, high-frequency trading, digital voting machines that can be easily manipulated. We got another call. Hi, go ahead, caller.
Yes, I'm Dr. Jack Block at William-Patterson University. I teach a freshman world history, which used to be Western Civ. And I asked my students when they came, do you know the differences among capitalism, socialism, and fascism? They could not explain what capitalism was. These are New Jersey students who are, I'm sure, more prepared than in other states. Socialism, they thought, was equal to fascism. And so having been a teacher all my life, I can say that it's very superficial, one-sided textbooks that really don't go into critical thinking or comparison of sources. That's my first point. The second, unfortunately, you always our government takes the lowest person. I heard that Darren Wilson was fired. He will get no severance pay, as if to pacify blacks and to say, well, you see, we've done something, instead of going to the higher echelons, to the people who are really the mayor, the council, the people who really make the decisions on how police should behave. And I see that also with Jamie Dimon. Chase Bank reprimanded a few traders and so on, or whatever. But Jamie Dimon was kept sacred. And same with Donald Rumsfeld and Cheney and others who really were behind the torture. Mm-hmm. But the small person, you know, was indicted by the army. So I just wanted to share those two issues of how unfortunate it is that the students don't realize the big themes. They're impressed by small events that really don't shed light on major issues. And, well, I wanted to share that with you because I thought you might be interested in what college freshmen think and come to class at the beginning.
Okay. Caller, we have 30 seconds.
Hello. I had thought it was called the free enterprise system. Why do people say we have a capitalistic system? That's what I'm confused about a little, because when I had studied in school. I thought we were the free enterprise system.
Yeah, that sounds like it's fixed. Nothing's a free, like a laissez hands off. It's not that. It's a rigged game. Thank you for pointing that out. I really appreciate your call. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again on Dark Matter Radio.